Welcome back to the Epics Podcast. I started this podcast because I believe that the foundation of hate and discrimination in our world comes from a lack of understanding of those who are different from ourselves. We plan to combat that by hearing everyone's stories so that we may better understand them and be a part of creating real positive change. Joining me on the podcast this week is Mac McGregor. Mac is the author of Positive Masculinity Now, which takes a deep dive into gender expectations, socialization, and messaging. Before their transition, Mac was a successful female athlete, an inductee to the U.S. Karate Hall of Fame, and a business owner. Since then, Mac has served as the Seattle City Commissioner from 2011 to 2016 and acted as a keynote speaker on the subjects of masculine behavior and sexuality. Mac is a creative public speaker and runs several self-help workshops for men to develop healthy masculine qualities, to learn about the queer community, and to overcome toxicity. Mac is now known as the Gender Sensei and is working to educate and train various corporations, colleges, and groups on topics concerning diversity, gender, and healthy masculinity, and being true to themselves. He's a dedicated, heartfelt activist and educator who focuses every part of his existence on creating a world where people can feel free to be their authentic selves. On this episode, we talked about how martial arts impacted his life. He talked about his transition and how to look at gender norms in a new way. It was really helpful to me. So let's take a listen and dive into Mac's epic story. Welcome, Mac. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Alex. Good to be here.
Absolutely. Would you be able to just introduce yourself and describe yourself physically, what you look like and where you are for those of us who can't see you?
What I look like? Well, I'm in Seattle, Washington. I'm in my mid-50s, and I have been a sober daddy for a while. I'm former U.S. karate champion, so I'm, you know, in decent shape for an old guy. I have an interesting background. I started martial arts when I was 6 years old, and I call it my soulmate because I came from a very dysfunctional family, and it gave me a positive place to put my energy. And I was a kid with a lot of energy, so it could have gone in many directions. And I'm glad that I found the martial arts, and it becomes like a family. It's not a seasonal sport. It's something you do for a lifetime. And now I've been over 50 years as a martial artist. And I would say that that has been the most influential thing in my life, and many lessons that I teach about when I speak and facilitate meetings are lessons I've gained through my long history of martial arts training and teaching. I've been inducted into the Martial Arts Hall of Fame twice as a master teacher and as a competitor and former world champion fighter. And then I started changing my name. I was born in my first test of life, you know, when they look at a baby in the hospital, usually. there's usually a nurse that writes a letter down on a piece of paper, and I call that the magic letter. And that letter follows us the rest of our lives. And it's, you only have in most places two choices of which letter that is, and that's an M or an F. And in that first test of life, they gave me an F. and that didn't fit me. And even though I was raised in the Bible Belt and had zero, literally zero exposure to the LGBTQ plus community, I started changing my name to a masculine name, playing with other kids at 4 and 5 years old. So I knew that the name I was given, which was very much like a Southern Belle Scarlett O'Hara type name, did not fit me at all. And of course, in that kind of environment, in the Bible Belt, the gender roles are very defined, and they're pretty rigid, actually. So, you know, that was interesting to navigate as a young person who didn't fit the mold that they wanted me to fit, right? And yet loved my community. As far as the people, I'm a very community-minded person, and I always have been. So, you know, the threat, if you don't fit the mold in those communities, is the loss of community. So figuring out how to navigate that as a young person was very challenging. And I'm a very keen, I've always had a keen sense of reading the room and reading people. And I think being who I am and growing up in that environment, of course, helped hone those skills. Also, growing up with a dysfunctional family helps hone those skills. You have to learn how to read the room when you walk in. And for your safety, you know, and so, and then the martial arts helps teach you all those skills as well. And develop, you know, helps you develop those skills. So I've, you know, that helped me as a teacher. It's helped me as a coach. It's helped me just navigate life, learning all those skills overall. And after I retired from martial arts competition, which I was 39 when I did that, so I had a long competition career, very long in a contact sport. I was the oldest person, male or female, on the U.S. karate team at 39, and I had the 18 and 19-year-olds calling me the grandparent of the team. And I won 2 medals in the world championships at 39 and decided that would be a really good time to retire on top. And so that's what I did. And that allowed me then to pursue my gender transition. And so I am a trans man, trans masculine person who teaches now, as well as martial arts stuff, I teach about gender and diversity. And I started a nonprofit about 4 years ago called Positive Masculinity. And I decided, you know, with all that's going on with the YouTube move, the Me Too movement, there was all this talk about the patriarchy and toxic masculinity, but I found that very few masculine people were involved in the conversation. Hmm. And I, of course, with you know, excluding the few outliers that were saying that women talking about how the patriarchy had affected them was taking away their masculinity and challenging their masculinity. I'm talking about people being involved in the conversation in some healthy way. Right. And so I got this idea of, well, what if we got all these different types of masculine people together, different ages, different ethnicities, different backgrounds, different lived experiences, to discuss how the patriarchy and the masculine model, the traditional masculine model, has affected all of us. Because it hasn't just hurt women.
Right.
And I don't want to take away from what it's done to women, because it's, you know, it's had a great effect on them. But it's also affected us. The famous activist Bell Hooks said the first victim of the patriarchy are little boys, because it shuts a part of them down by telling them they can't access the emotional part of who they are, right? Mm. And I think that that's, you know, there's so much there we can talk about, but this is the work that I am pouring my life into now, is helping people that identify as masculine people be able to thrive and overcome that messaging and modeling that no longer serves us well.
And then what ended up getting you into martial arts in the first place? What drew you to that? Because it seems like it had such a big impact on your life. You called it your soulmate is martial arts, yeah. Right?
Yeah, I truly think it saved my life, probably, because like I said, I was a kid with a lot of energy and a very dysfunctional family. You know, my mom is bipolar and borderline and is on her 10th marriage, 10th or 11th marriage now. It's hard to keep up with. It was a rotating door. And so, you know, just, you know, she just wasn't really very involved, right? So finding a positive place to be with adults that were giving guidance, but in a loving, encouraging way, you know, it was just a lifesaver. Really was. Yeah.
And you were obviously very good at it. I mean, performing at a very high level, dedicating yourself to it to this point, to the point of being highly awarded until the age of, you know, until your elder years of 39.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned how you grew up and immediately kind of one upon gaining the concept of gender, it seems almost you kind of realized that your name didn't fit you and you, who you were, didn't quite fit. Right. What was there a part of martial arts that allowed you to escape kind of gender for that? Because it's, I feel like in a lot of sports society, it's really easy for society to kind of place more gender normalcy onto different sports. You know what I mean? So like football is a boy sport, volleyball is a girl sport. Obviously we know that's all ridiculous, but is there something about martial arts that was more like gender neutral in a way that was freeing in that sense?
Well, it gave me an outlet to be more masculine. I will say that. The martial arts is an extremely masculine-led sport and art. You know, it's both a sport and art. I mean, I did both. I've done both parts of it, right? I trained in very traditional martial arts. And prior to transition, I was the highest ranking female martial artist cumulatively in the world. I have a fourth degree black belt or above in 17 different arts, but I just love learning. And to me, every art has a strength and a weakness, and another art will fill the weakness of one art, right? It's so interesting how it all works together. I like to have a lot of tools in my toolbox is what I, what I say. So, you know, it did give me that outlet to be masculine and to show strength and assertiveness. And, you know, it also coming from a place where, you know, I think I saw my mother, her second husband beat her. I was a little kid watching this, and I'll never forget the experience of being a small child, like 5 years old, and seeing this happen, because I would hear the commotion and come out of my bedroom and look down the hall and see what was going on. And I couldn't do anything to help, right? Because I was too little, and this was an adult man, you know, beating her. And, you know, there's something also, I think, in me that drew me to this because of that lived experience. And I've spent then my life empowering other people. I've taught self-defense literally all over the world, in women's shelters, women's prisons. I've taught it to all kinds of people, to LGBTQ people, to children, just to have the knowledge to be able to take care of themselves and get themselves to safety. So I think I had an inner draw in that way too, because I never wanted to feel helpless like that again.
Yeah. And I didn't make it past, I couldn't even tell you what color belt I made it to as a child, but not very far. There's not a lot of discipline in my life, which anyone who knows me won't be super shocked by that. But I was wondering a little bit about you. You also kind of mentioned that when you were done with sort of your martial arts career in terms of your, the competition, right?
Right. I still teach, coach, but yeah.
Right. And so when you were done competing, you kind of noted that was a kind of a point where you decided it was a good time to transition. Was there something specific about that period of time or that event that made that decision? Because you already mentioned how early you kind of had this knowledge of yourself, right? From a very young age. And so what was unique about that point of your life that became the right time to transition?
Yeah, so, you know, only about 100 athletes in any sport, and I'm going to qualify that with saying any sport that is not a big team sport like baseball, or, you know, that requires many people on each team, only about 100 athletes in other sports in any country get the opportunity to be on a team representing their country. So in other words, you know, I was in the top 100 karate athletes in the United States, chosen to have an opportunity to be on the U.S. karate team from the time I was 17, you know, through 39. And it's an extremely long competitive career, but they would have not allowed me to compete if I had transitioned. So I really weighed that within myself, you know, and understood how rare that opportunity is and how unique it is to have that opportunity, and wanted to ride that ride as long as I could. It, you know, the martial arts gave me so many learning experiences, but also it allowed me to travel the world, which is just, there's not a better education than travel, because people need to get out of their little pocket of wherever they live and see how much bigger the world is. And when you do that, it expands your world, right?
Right.
Yeah. You learn about other cultures and the way other people live. And it, you know, it really is expanding. And so I wouldn't have traded that for anything. I mean, there's a part of me that wishes I could have gone through that earlier, but I definitely am grateful for the opportunity I had through the martial arts. Yeah.
And to compete. Well, if anything, it kind of speaks to what you're saying of your soulmate being martial arts, that you're willing to sacrifice really a piece of yourself to compete as long as you could. And I am always, one of the things that I don't always feel like I feel like is one of the biggest barriers to to me, understanding the journey of someone who's transitioned is the decision of when to transition. Because I, to an extent, I can understand the concept of, I don't feel like this is who I am, so I want to change it. And the decision of when to do that sounds so much harder. And I'm sure you must have wrestled with that throughout your career. And so, yeah, so that I was just really drawn to that question because, you know, from as an outsider, I'm kind of thinking, what are you doing? Like, you're sacrificing who you are. And to you, it seems like it's also martial arts is a part of who you are. So you're finding the balance.
It is finding the balance. And then after I retired at 39, what I did was I started doing more research. And here's an interesting thing. You know, a lot of trans people, they hate their body, right? Mm-hmm. The body they were born with. I never had that experience. And the reason is not that I didn't have some what they call gender dysphoria, some parts of my body I wanted to change that I didn't feel like represented me well. It's that my body had been a fine-tuned machine for me as an athlete that had given me a lot of wonderful experiences and a lot of privileges. And so I appreciated a lot of the things my body did for me and the way my body works for me, right? It had done great things. And so I was very keen on researching where the best and healthiest places to transition were before I jumped into that as well. And where I was in Florida at the time, there were not experts. There was a big trans community to talk to have support. There were not experts that, you know, were really well-versed in treating trans people. And so that's what led me to Seattle, honestly, is that I did the research and Seattle had a thriving trans community, you know, where I could talk to people who've been through this experience and gain knowledge from them. And they also had doctors and therapists and all the people that have experience in working with the trans community. So that's what brought me here.
Did you have any sort of connection with that community before your transition while you were still competing? Or was that something that happened just afterwards during your research? And then did it make a big impact, like finding that community and being a part of people who really understood you?
So I did have a few folks that I knew here and was able to come visit a couple times before I moved here, you know. And one of the funny things, if, you know, for those of you that have never been to Seattle, is if you visit Seattle in the summer, Seattle will seduce you because it's absolutely beautiful, especially when you come from a place like Florida, where in the summer it's so hot. The only time you want to be outside is if you're in a swimming pool or in the ocean, right? It's too humid and hot. And the summers here are just gorgeous. The humidity is much lower, right? The mountain is out. That's how we say the sun is out. We say the mountain is out. We see a beautiful Mount Rainier. And it's just, and I love to hike and kayak, and that's such a big thing here. And yeah, so I visited here, it was in the summer. And, you know, growing up in Florida, I used to make fun of snowbirds all the time. Well, now I understand when you have 4 or 5 months of gray, I understand why snowbirds go to sunny places. But yes, finding community here and finding other trans people who've been through this process that I could talk to. Also trans people who had kept their career, trying to navigate. I was not a trans. A lot of trans people want to move somewhere when they transition new and come out as this other person, right? Because they don't want to have to deal with all the people who knew them before.
Right.
Trying to explain this and getting people to, you know, be okay with the new name and the new gender. And so, you know, I wanted to be able to keep my career because my career, you know, had been a big part of me. Well, it's a huge part of me. I'm just a teacher at heart. And I was going to keep using, you know, my past experience to help propel me forward. And so I wanted to also talk to people, and I made friends with people who stayed in their career and still moved forward as well, who had transitioned. And that was a great help to be able to have conversations with them about how they navigated that.
Yeah. And there's a part of that that makes sense to me of transitioning and then kind of restarting a new life in a way. you know, there's less friction of having to redefine yourself to so many people and all these things. Were there any barriers for you to decide to not change careers and to use your past career before you had transitioned? Was there any hardship that came with that?
Well, of course, there were some people who were skeptical. I had some, I had all my life fought for women's rights as a female athlete. Mm. I mean, you know, I will tell you that women in sports, one of the interesting things is even on teams like the U.S. karate team or the U.S. whatever team, the women's team almost never gets the same amount of money, training, mm-hmm. They don't get the same training facilities, the same anything, the same accommodations when we travel. It's challenging. So, of course, I was a part of working for, you know, things for women as far as rights as athletes mm-hmm. and things like that. So I did have a lot of women that were fellow activist friends who were, well, they were not happy that I was like, you know, they kind of said, you're joining the other team, right?
Right. It's a betrayal almost.
It's a betrayal, right. And I also, you know, one of the things that also was hard for me, one of the challenges was I had broken a lot of glass ceilings as, you know, one of the top female martial artists in the world, right? And so I had a lot of women that looked up to me in that way and that, you know, said how I encouraged them to, you know, in their journey in training and things. And so I, you know, there was a part of me that was worried I was letting them down, you know, and how that would come across to them. So yeah, that was challenging. And of course, some of them said they're, you know, oh, you're going to take testosterone and become one of those male chauvinist pigs. I actually had a friend say that to me.
Hmm.
And my comment to her was, how is a shot of testosterone going to erase 42 years of lived experience?
Right.
I just don't see. Well, now she's come back around and sees that I still constantly, you know, work for equality and equity and, you know, but, you know, she wasn't sure, you know, that was her initial thought, you know, and I'll tell you that I had my own struggle inside because I had faced a lot of sexism as a female athlete mm-hmm. and small business owner. I owned a dojo myself for many years. And one of the things that female athletes get told all the time, no matter how good you are, I could win everything there is to win, right? And there are some people that would look at me and say, you're really good for a girl.
Right.
And that kind of BS, you know, which is, you know, people need to stop saying that to young people. I mean, if you're good at something, you're good at something.
Mm-hmm.
Not you're good for a heavy kid or you're good for a girl or you're good for a short kid or whatever. You know, people would use these qualifiers to make themselves feel better, right?
Right.
And so I had put up with sexism around, you know, as an athlete and a business owner. And so I had a little battle within myself where I questioned, do I want to be a part of this group of people who has done a lot of damage to other people?
Mm.
And I'll tell you, you know, one of the greater influences in my life as a young person was my grandparents. And my grandfather was an amazing example to me because my mom had me at 16. My grandparents helped care for me in my younger years. And my grandfather and I were fishing buddies and I was his little mini me. And he'd teach me a lot of life lessons in the fishing boat, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, he always taught me that the way to create change is from within. He always taught me that you can't sit outside of a group and point a finger at a group of people or an organization and say, that's awful. They need to do better or they need to change. It's not going to do anything to help change if you stand outside and complain about it. You have to get in there and get involved to help create change.
Mm.
And that's a life thing that he instilled within me. And he had passed away by this time, by the time I was moved to Seattle and was going through this. But as I was questioning this, I heard his voice in the back of my head saying that. And it reminded me, you know, really what we need is more good men, mm-hmm. more good masculine people speaking up, standing up for the right thing. And that's what gave me the green light to go.
Mm. I'm thinking a lot about what that must have felt like to, I think, particularly as a female athlete, because I think female athletes are in a unique position when we talk about women's rights, because they're literally on stage in a lot of cases, right? And there's really easy ways to compare them to their male counterparts in different ways. I remember I saw a video of someone, a WNBA player, who was responding to, you know, kind of the classic argument of, we don't get paid enough. Well, that's because the WNBA doesn't produce as much money as the NBA. And she was saying, well, no, that's not it. We don't get paid the same percentage. We're not right. asking to be paid the same. I'm not asking to be paid the same as LeBron James. I'm asking to be paid the same percentage as them. And so we don't realize, and a lot of times we don't realize a lot of these differences. And I think that's where it's really easy to see, you know, like one of my first thoughts is always the U.S. soccer teams, you know, the women's team has been so successful for so long and they still make so much less. Right. And so
that's changed recently.
Right. Thanks. Right. Actually, I did think of that as well. But I feel like women athletes, female athletes are particularly in the spotlight when it comes to women's rights issues, and you being a highly successful female athlete, I can't imagine the wrestling you have to go through before transitioning away from that, especially, you know, like you said, fighting for that side of it. And you said something that I thought was really profound, which was like, do I want to be a part of this group of people who have done so much damage to my life? And that really struck me for a second. I was like, oh my gosh, because it's not just because for you personally, it's a feeling of, you know, becoming more of who you are. That's kind of how I interpret it.
Yes, and, definitely.
But you're also, there's also this other part of you, the whole, you know, 39 years of lived experience as a female athlete, as this person who's fighting for women's rights. And not that you aren't for that now. Becoming a man doesn't make you against women's rights.
No.
But I can imagine that it's a big struggle.
Oh, it was a big struggle. Yeah, I felt like, you know, it was kind of a dark night of the soul, you know, wrestling in my sleep moment, right? Mm. It's like that, you know, wrestling with this, you know, life journey. Like, what am I going to do with this? You know, do I just shove that part of me down, or do I embrace it somehow and integrate it into all of this with the amazing experience I've had walking the world on the other side? It actually, I am 100% convinced, makes me a better man.
Mm.
Yeah. Makes me a better man by far. And one of the most interesting things is, due to my history in the martial arts, I never thought how this would all come around full circle. Cis men, and just to define that for your audience that may not know, you know, trans means opposites in science and biology. So it means I was born not feeling like my inner self matched my outer body. Today's societal norms, I will add that to it. Cis means matching in biological science. So it means you were born with that matching according to today's societal norms. But my martial arts experience allows me to teach cis men, and cis men will listen because I'm a warrior, because of my warrior background. Mm. I have taught the U.S. Border Patrol. I teach Seattle Police Department Gender 101. Every new recruit at Seattle Police Department has to go through my class on gender. It's a requirement. So I've taught at the military base here. The general has had me come in and teach gender 101. These kinds of warrior guys will listen to me because of my warrior background, and they will have respect for that. It's so interesting how I never even saw that coming. You know, how I'd be able to talk about this gender journey and gender expectations and all of that, and people would listen due to the background of the martial arts.
That is interesting. It's an obviously, you're not taking advantage because of that or anything. It's still just who you are. But I find that very fascinating. And I've said this multiple times. I think I've said this recently on a different episode as well, where I don't want to by any means take advantage of the trans community. But I feel like in a lot of ways, we underutilize or underappreciate the experiences of our trans community. Because when we talk about gender norms and gender stereotypes, I feel like we can really learn a lot from your lived experience. All of the women's rights fight that I have in me comes from a desire to make a better world for my wife and for other girls like her, or my mother or my sister. You know, it's a separate experience from my own. I don't live the same experience myself. It means a lot to me because I love my wife, but it's a different experience. And so when I was preparing for our interview, I saw that you refer to yourself as the gender sensei. And that makes sense to me because you've lived both of those. And so you have a beautiful insight into what it's like to live as a woman, because you did it for 39 years and now you live as a man. And so you know what that's like. And so tell me a little bit about how the one experience informs the other. How does your lived experience as a woman impact how you live your life as a man that maybe you wouldn't have thought of before?
Wow, so many ways. And yeah, thank you for that. And just let me say about what you said about that, valuing that lived experience. You know, the Native American community has valued two-spirit people, they call, as shaman for a long time because of that more vast understanding, right? And I do think it's great to recognize that. So some of the ways that my past experience has influenced me now, for instance, when I walk down the street in the evening, you know, with my beard and my mustache now, and a woman's walking alone, and I see, I'm so keen to her behavior if she's comfortable or not. Much more keen than your average cis guy, because they've never had that experience.
Right.
And so if she starts walking faster, I'm, of course, from my martial arts, and I've done a lot of bodyguarding work due to my martial arts as well. I'm very good at reading body language. And if she starts walking faster, you know, putting her head down, I back off and give her a lot of space. I change my pace to give her more space so she feels safe, because I see that, right? Because I lived it. Another thing, I walk into a restaurant now and I've had a hostess or host walk right past a woman that's been waiting longer when I walk in, and they look at me as a middle-aged businessman. They'll walk right up to me and ask if I'm ready to be seated. And I am aware of that because of that experience, and I point it out. And most guys, it just totally goes over their head because they don't see it, right?
You're right.
It's not in their experience, so they don't see it, right? It's not that they're trying to be bad or mean. It's just that they don't recognize it. And, you know, I've had women, when I call it out, look at me like they're so surprised that a guy actually recognized it, right? And I also, you know, I think am conscious of giving women the mic. You know,
right,
asking for their opinion on things when I'm in a meeting. And, you know, when I see that they're not as quick sometimes to speak up, I recognize why. You know, when there's two women in a room full of five or six guys, you know, and I call them forward, you know. So I think those things are much more in the forefront of my mind than the average guy. That's some of the ways that I think it affects how I walk in the world.
Right. And I love that, because these aren't things that cisgendered men can't do and can't learn.
Right.
But you innately kind of, or more naturally, I guess, adopted these things. And, you know, it brings up something to mind for me that, like, in my life, I don't know how much I've talked about this on my podcast, but I originally wanted to be a pastor. And the beginning, yeah, there's a lot of people who were going to be, maybe didn't. I found that out throughout my journey. And I ultimately decided that the church wasn't the place for me to do the work I wanted to do, because I wanted to do social justice work. And that was what I really felt called to. And not that you can't do social justice work in the church. You can't. Many people can. It didn't feel like the right space for me to do it the way I wanted to do it. And a big part of that for me was for me to pursue a career in that field, I had to I had to then be faced with some decisions. And I told my wife at one point, I was like, I don't know if I ever would want to be like a lead pastor, for example. I don't know if I want to be in charge of other people. And, you know, when we talk about the church, in particular, other women, because I don't want people in leadership to look like me anymore. That's the whole reason I want to go and do social justice work, because I don't feel like that the leadership should all look like people like me. What came to mind for me was that we can learn these things. And so that transitioned me into what I wanted to ask you about next, which is, you know, you mentioned, you know, your gender classes. Can you tell me a little bit about what are some of the kind of core ideals or maybe core questions that you get in your gender classes? What are you trying to accomplish with those?
Well, the same thing I am trying to accomplish, you know, with the book that I wrote, and my book is titled Positive Masculinity Now, but I will say this, it's not just about masculinity. It's about getting people, this is the same thing I do in the class, to go back as a conscious adult and examine the way you were socialized around gender ideals and expectations, because what happens is those things help us form our belief systems. They inform how we walk in the world, how we judge ourselves and other people. They have great impacts on our lives, but most people, you know, we take all this in as a young person from our parents and grandparents and extended family and our schools, our coaches, our teachers, our faith community, if we're a part of one. And then most people just walk that way in life and never go back and reexamine and decide, now does this still serve me well as a conscious adult when I can make my own decisions? They just go along with these beliefs. Like how should I be in the world as a man? How should I walk in the world? What does that mean? Right? And how should women act? Like, you know, I ask questions to people like, what does it mean when someone says to a young girl, act like a lady? Which growing up in the South, I heard a lot, you know, you need to act like a lady. When somebody says that to you, they're saying that because they don't think you're doing it right.
Right.
And of course, it's a bit subjective because it depends on who says it to you, what they actually mean, right?
I think a bit subjective is also kind too. It's very subjective.
Yeah. And when they say to a little boy, you know, man up or toughen up, sure. What are they saying to that little boy? You know, one of the interesting experiences I've had as a coach in the martial arts is seeing brothers and sisters grow up in the same home of a family who I'm teaching this family martial arts to, and taking them to competitions and seeing how different the little girl and little boy are treated when they show emotion around something that happens in a competition or in class. And I've seen parents at tournaments flat out tell the little boy he better not cry and show emotion when his little sister can, you know, she took a bad hit. She's allowed to cry and have emotion about it. But he's told to shut that part of himself down right away.
Right.
That's not okay as a boy. And so, you know, I'd get people to go back and literally go back and reexamine what was modeled to you around how you should behave as a man or a woman? And how has that affected you? I get them to literally, and in the book, in each chapter, I have worksheets in the back where you actually go through these experiences and write things down and take notes. I mean, you're really going through an evaluation of this. I think one of the hard things about this introspective work is I'm asking people to go back and think of things that were modeled to them by people they care about. Because these, like I said, are your parents and grandparents and teachers and coaches that you cared about, you know, aunts and uncles that you loved, so on. And I think sometimes it's hard for us to look at them and be able to find flaws, find that they maybe weren't always right.
Right.
But I mean, come on, we're all human beings and they can still have good things that they taught us and some parts that we don't want to carry forward, right? As wonderful as my grandfather was to me, there are some things that he did that were just too traditional and I would never want to carry forward. you know, like he gave my grandmother an allowance.
Oh, jeez.
I mean, that's very old fashioned, right? But she was a homemaker, you know, and in his era, right, that wasn't valued the same as him going out and having a career, right?
Right. Yeah, no, I find it interesting. And I think about this a lot because I am the parent of two young boys. And so we talk about kind of gender norms a lot, mostly between me and my wife, but also through with our kids and different things. And we have, you know, we have books. We have the book Pink is for Boys and some of these other books and stuff like that. And we let our kids wear whatever color they want. My son has Elsa, you know, pajamas and whatever. And I think that a lot of times when evaluating kind of gender norms, a lot of it doesn't make sense to me because it seems strange to me that something can be defined as one gender or another, particularly things like that. And maybe I'm thinking of this a little too narrowly, you know, towards kind of children's stuff, but like particularly like clothes and all these things.
Right.
And so it's always strange to me, and particularly when you use some of these phrases like man up, like what does that even mean? It's confusing, right?
Yeah, it is. And I think it's great that you know you're doing that and giving your kids the freedom to figure out who they are, right? You know, one of some of the messaging that I put out and teach through positive masculinity through my nonprofit are things like clothing and fabric don't have a gender.
Mm-hmm.
Activities don't have a gender.
Right.
So you can't say, you know, like baseball is for boys, it's not for girls or whatever. You know, I have one of my top black belts who turned out to be a fabulous martial artist and great teacher. And she was born in the 60s, but she wanted to take martial arts as a young kid. And her parents literally told her that's not for girls. And she had to wait till she went away to college and was away from home, and her college offered a martial arts class, and that's how she started. But she became a fabulous martial artist and is a great martial arts teacher now. But if she'd have listened to that conditioning, she would have shut that down and never tried it, she'd have never known that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's these kinds of messages that what I'm trying to get people to do is rethink them, and let's quit passing that old limiting messaging on.
Now, one thing I'm wondering a little bit about when you're talking about kind of redefining masculinity, to me, one of the things that I struggle with when we talk about some of these gender conversations is I don't really know how to define it correctly. And, you know, I think it's one thing to say redefining masculinity, but oftentimes I think of it as when I talk about redefining gender norms, in my mind, I'm often thinking of it as kind of almost eliminating gender norms. And so when you talk about positive masculinity or redefining masculinity, I feel like there's a piece of me that doesn't quite understand that yet, because in my mind we're eliminating that as a factor in a way, and I know I'm missing something. So I don't know what it is.
Yeah, Alex, you'd be in my advanced class already, because you're listen, that's my goal. My goal is exactly what you're saying, is that we eliminate that and we let people be who they are, right? And I ask this question all over the world because I like to challenge people's thinking.
Mm.
I ask people, define masculinity all over the world. I ask groups of men this all over the world. And I'm talking all kinds of different groups of men. Gay, straight, bi, you know, cis, trans. I even ask, you know, it's really interesting, even in the trans masculine community, ask them to define it, you know?
Right.
And I ask women this too, because it's really interesting. Women perpetuate the same old messaging because they've been fed the same messaging of what it's supposed to be, right? But my goal is to get to where we don't have this and get people to understand that we're all a blend of masculine and feminine energies. And I would go back to my martial arts training and talk about the yin and the yang. The yin and the yang, you know, in America, people try to simplify that as male and female, but that's not what it means. So the yin energy is what people associate with female, but the yin energy is more nurturing, more reaffirming. You know, it's the holding, the nurturing, the the encouraging, reaffirming who you are, that kind of energy. The yang energy, which is what some people associate with the masculine, but it's much more complicated than that.
Sure.
The yang energy is action-oriented. So the yang energy is still like, it still can be compassionate and nurturing, but in the way of protecting, in the way of providing, right? In the way of helping the person learn how to overcome obstacles. Does that make sense? It's more sure. Action. So that's, you know, I go back to that because I think that helps us understand a little bit of how we are a blend of those energies. And I love how when I teach about gender, you know, there's some people that didn't pay attention in biology class. And I tell, you know, a lot of cis guys that we all have some estrogen and some testosterone in our systems. And I've had guys argue with me that they have no estrogen. There's no way I have estrogen. And I said, look, if you didn't have any estrogen, you should be grateful, because if you didn't have any, you'd probably be beating your chest and scratching your balls all the time or something. You
know? Right.
That helps balance us, right? We all have a blend of these things, and it, even biologically, and it helps to balance us. And that's what we need to understand is that we need to get to this place where we understand we are a blend. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you may feel a little more on the yang side or a little more on the yin side, depending on the situation or just where you are in that moment.
I don't know if I qualify for your advanced class or not. I still feel a little confused. But no, what I think is helpful about that, though, is removing the terms of masculine and feminine, because masculine is so easily just immediately replaced with the word male.
Yes.
And feminine is so easily replaced with the word female. And that, I think, removing that aspect of it is really helpful in terms of my thought process and what I was getting at there. Because when you describe something as masculine, it means it's more for men. Like, that's right. Kind of how I hear that term.
That's the American, Western, it's a Western.
Sure, yes. Sure. And so the yin-yang of that is helpful to me because I understand less about yin and yang. So I get, in a way, that helps me understand it. Or at least, you know, come to terms with it better. And I remember someone describing this to me, and I don't like to act like I know what I'm talking about. But I remember at one point someone talking about the yin and yang. And when you can immediately visualize a symbol, everyone can who's listening to this. And there's always, it's the black and the white, and there's always the white dot in the black and the black dot in the white. And so it's what you were saying too. There's a blend of it, and I love. Yep. That picture is really helping me in this conversation. It's something I think a lot about because I want to learn more about it. We have all sorts of conversation now in our culture about gender and gender norms and normalizing different gender normalcies. And that's always been a piece that's helped me. And that was, for some reason, you unlocked it. I think maybe I'm ready for the next class now. But yeah, that's really helpful.
And one interesting thing, let me just follow up on that. One interesting thing is, like I said, I've asked this question all over the world to groups of men, define masculinity to me without, my qualifier is without using a body part. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting what comes out. A lot of guys, I mean, one, they sit there, you know, and you can see the wheels turning, right? They're trying to think of something. And then maybe somebody will say, well, the masculine is more mechanically minded. That's something that has come up several times.
Okay.
And then somebody will raise their hand and debunk that because they'll say, well, the one in our family that can fix everything is my Aunt Sally.
That's right. I immediately thought of my wife as more mechanically minded than I am.
Yeah, so. My wife is too. She's more mechanically minded than I am. She's a good fix. Yeah. She fixes everything. So, yeah. So, you know, there's always, I'm saying, when somebody brings up a personality trait that they associate with the masculine, there's always somebody that can say, oh no, there's women that do that too. You know, so we're trying to take biological sex and think that determines our personality characteristics. And we're not taking into our thought around that, how much we've been socialized and how much that determines what we think we're supposed to do and be personality-wise according to our gender, how much that affects us, right? It's so interesting. When I moved to Seattle, I had never seen this in the South, and I found it to be a beautiful thing. Because in Seattle, men here and masculine people are not as afraid as where I grew up in the South to show tenderness and their nurturing side. So in the South, I've never seen a man, you know how women wrap the baby around their chest, around their body. I don't remember what they call that wrap, but when the baby's just wrapped around you with material. Here, I've seen men with beards and, mm-hmm. you know,
right,
goatees, all that, walking into a brewery, you know, with their baby wrapped to their chest, you know, to get some microbrew, you know. And I mean, the first time I saw that, I remember stopping in my tracks and just being like, wow. Mm. And thinking how cool that is that guy is secure enough and feels that it's okay in this community to show his nurturing side. Because you wouldn't see that in the South.
Right.
Not for somebody who was raised there. It's just unheard of, right? Because the nurturing, just to take this and how this has affected our psyche, you know, we have associated being the nurturer with the female, right? And so how much has that affected fathers' relationships with their children? And creating some distance there, you know, especially in public, right? And I think that's sad. And that's something,
yeah.
That's one of those things that we can reexamine and say, hey, that doesn't serve me well. That's not I don't want that distance between my child and I, right?
Right, right. Yeah, no, I remember having conversations with my wife when our first son started preschool, because I was always the only dad who would show up to pick up. And she didn't understand why that was uncomfortable. And I was like, well, I'm not uncomfortable being there, but there's a certain expectation. There's just, you can kind of feel people's thoughts a little bit. And I can't describe it in a better way than that necessarily. And turns out I ended up being friends with most of those women anyways. But so it wasn't a problem. But you think of it when you're kind of the only person doing something that is opposite of what your gender norm is usually
doing.
Yeah,
you do. Yeah, it stands out. When you don't see other people that look like you there, it always stands out, right?
I couldn't help but ask this question. Do you have a favorite or best or favorite answer that you've gotten when you've asked people to define masculinity? Is there one answer that you always think of that someone's given you over the years?
Well, you know, I always laugh at the guys who stumble around and say, well, we're stronger, we're tougher.
Sure.
You know, and I mean, because that one, you know, people, I a lot of times I'll lead, I facilitate, but, you know, I let the audience, you know, pipe back at that, because I think it's pretty funny coming from them. You know, how many men want to go through childbirth if you want to talk about toughness, right?
Right. No, I've been there. It's not for me.
I've seen a baby before and as well. I don't want to do that either. I have no desire to do that, you know, and then, you know, people will bring up like Serena Williams or,
sure.
you know, Martina Navratilova or Ronda Rousey, or, you know, we could talk about how many strong, tough women there are out there in the world. And so, I mean, that one always cracks me up. But I think the funniest one is the guys that after we go through a few rounds of this, they just go, well, I can't come up with anything. And this is boggling my mind. You know, that's the one that, you know, because I'm really getting them to think then. Mm. About how conditioned they've been. And one of the things I love to challenge people is how much of your thinking is really your own thinking, or how much are you just right. parroting in crap you were fed, you know, without rethinking it, you know, with a conscious adult mind. So
I like to think my thoughts are my own, but so I don't really like that a whole lot, but I'll be up late tonight thinking about that.
Well, we're all kind of a conglomeration of, right, things that we've
exactly.
been
studying. Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, I want to just take a moment now and give you an opportunity to speak to those of us who have a very different story from your own. Those of us who are cisgendered. And by the way, I did want to point out, I've been using the term cisgendered for a long time. I actually never knew that's what it actually meant when you defined it for me. So I really appreciated that. But... Right. speaking to those of us who have a very different story from us, who are cisgendered and don't understand the transition that you had to go through and the lived experiences that you've had on both sides of our gender norms and, you know, dissecting gender as you have, what would you hope that we better understand after hearing your story?
I hope that it makes you curious. I hope that it makes you more curious and open to listen to other people's stories and experiences and not feel threatened by people that are different. You know, I would have to say, like I said earlier about the fact that the martial arts gave me the privilege to travel the world. One of the, you know, most expansive things and the best learning experiences we can have is to talk to people that are different than us. If we talk to people that are just like us all the time and that's our only experience, boy, we're not growing at all.
Right.
So get out there and learn from people that have different life experiences. I try to do that. I challenge myself to do that all the time. And that is another gift that my grandfather gave me. He could talk to anybody from the president of a company to someone living on the street. And I so appreciate that. And I think everybody has an amazing story and something we can learn from them as long as we stay curious. That's the key to growth. Staying curious is the key to keeping our minds young and thriving. Is to stay curious about things, including ourselves. That curiosity isn't just about external things. It's about our own experience, like us getting curious about how we were socialized and how that affected us, right? It's starting to dive into that and be curious about the ways that's affected our lives and how we walked in the world.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing all of that. And again, just before we close, I also want to give you a chance to speak to those of who may be listening who really do resonate with your story, those who don't feel maybe at peace with the body they're born into or don't feel that they fit into the gender norms that are being fed to them and the thoughts that we've learned through others about what it means to be a man or to be a woman or a boy or a girl. And I want to give you a chance. What do you want to say to them?
First of all, find a group of supportive people. Find a group of people that resonate with you and that will give you support through your journey, because that's important as you travel this experience. And then you'll have that place you can go back to gain strength when it's hard out there to be yourself. You know, I try to set people up to have that place to go back and gain strength from, because the world can be really hard if you're different than the norms of the day, right? Mm-hmm. In any way, it's not just about gender. I mean, you know, you can be more mystical. You can be like, we can go on and on, right? About the ways that people can be different. And you know, our world tries to make us assimilate really hard. I mean, it pushes us to get in that lane and assimilate with everyone else. And it's challenging to think differently or to be different, but you got to find that small group of your inner circle, I call it, of people that will be there for you, support you, give you good feedback, sometimes call you in if you're out of line, but people you trust, but that care about you. Because I think that's so important when we go out into the world as people traveling a different path.
Yeah, no, I think that means so much. And I will tell you what I immediately thought of was this past summer. The thing I first thought of for myself is, you know, the nerds in the room, right? And I'm wearing my Star Wars hat now, and I've got, you know, Legos behind me.
I've got my Deadpool t-shirt on.
Absolutely. And I took my family last year to the Fan Expo here in Denver, the Comic-Con. And it was the first time I had been, actually. And when people asked me how it was, the first thing I would always tell people was, it was an incredible experience. And it was really cool. I mean, I got to see all these amazing people and, you know, some of these actors and actresses that I've been watching and obsessing over in different ways. But the thing that I loved the most about it was just walking around and feeling the energy in the room, because It was a place where everyone was free to be themselves. It was completely lowered inhibitions without, like, sober lowered inhibitions is the way I described it. And it's because people felt safe to be who they were. And I thought that was funny because they were doing that while dressed up as characters and other people. But it was this place where there was thousands of people there. I think they said over the course of the weekend, 10,000 people were there. And there was no one arguing with each other. Everyone was kind and nice to each other. We had our kids with us. People, you know, be nice to our kids, you know, make sure they didn't get trampled in different places, which we really appreciated. And when there's this sense of safety, it changes the whole dynamic. I had never been in a room with that many people where I felt zero conflict. It was so incredible. And that was immediately the feeling that I thought of when you were describing that. And I hope that that's I hope everyone has a chance to feel that way in whatever room they walk into. So, Mac, I want to take one last moment here to thank you again for coming on the show. I really appreciate you being so open with your story and vulnerable with us, and for spending the time with me today.
It's been a pleasure, Alex. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to my conversation with Mac. If you believe in what Epix is doing and love the content that we're creating, I'd be so grateful if you supported us on Patreon so we can spend more and more time bringing you epic guests with their stories to share with us. If you're interested in buying Mac's book, Positive Masculinity Now, that link will be in the description of this episode wherever you are listening to it. I highly encourage you to go out and get that book. Also, remember that I have a bookstore on my website full of resources that I've been using as a part of my ally journey. If you buy any of them through the links on my site, I get an affiliate commission, and you're not only supporting the author and a local bookstore, but you're also supporting the Epix podcast. This conversation around gender in our world is becoming more and more prevalent, and it's one that's very difficult for me because I don't feel like I always know how to define masculinity or femininity for that matter. And in this conversation with Mac, he really helped me to take the next step in that understanding, not just by taking the terms of masculine and feminine out of the conversation, but by replacing them with the ideas of yin and yang. Now, in full transparency, I don't think that I understand yin and yang any better than I do masculine and feminine, but I found it very helpful to detach those terms with the conversation when thinking about gender norms. Also, I never knew what the term cis meant. I understood that it was referring to me as a cis man to be cisgendered, but I never knew that what it meant was that I match what I was born with. And that was really cool thing to learn. I never knew where that term came from. Was there something that you learned from our conversation with Mac today? If there was, I would love it if you reached out and let me know what that was. Anywhere on social media, you can find me at Epix Pod. I would love to hear from you and get your feedback. And be sure you're subscribed to the Epix Podcast so you don't miss the next epic story. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening.